Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. There's a mouthful of memories in every family, especially if you're Sicilian. On this week's show, we'll examine Sicilian family food traditions from North Louisiana to the most southern tip of the boot. Despite his Sicilian heritage, Chef Nick Lama gives us a Northern Italian pasta and truffle lesson in the kitchen of his restaurant Avo. And Sal Impastato, the last of the Impastatos to own and operate the treasured Napoleon House in New Orleans' French Quarter, looks back at his family's heritage there. Then, Chef Cal Peternell stops by to fill us in on his latest project, a book that focuses on life with his restaurant family at Alice Waters' Chez Panisse. Get ready for our big family food reunion on this week's Louisiana Eats. On a quiet block of Magazine Street in Uptown New Orleans, a short distance from Audubon Park and the Mississippi River, is Avo, an intimate fine dining restaurant owned and operated by local chef Nick Lama. A third-generation Sicilian from a family with a long history in New Orleans, Nick most recently worked as chef de cuisine at Gautreaux's. At that time, he won Gambit's Emerging Chef Challenge. Nick graciously invited the Louisiana Eats crew into Avo's kitchen for a lesson in cooking Italian pasta.
Let me grab the truffles and I think we'll be all set.
Great.
The space is about the size of a postage stamp, bustling with prep cooks and busboys expertly navigating the narrow space as they prepared for that evening's dinner. As Nick started the process of boiling water on the stove, I asked him what it's like to grow up in an old New Orleans Italian food family.
So my dad's side had the St. Rock Seafood Market, and they took over that, I believe, in the 40s and ran it up until Hurricane Katrina. And so I kind of grew up a little bit in the New Orleans food scene and grew up around a lot of great seafood, and that's kind of how I developed my passion for cooking and food, and New Orleans food specifically. And then just traveling to Italy throughout, you know, my childhood and stuff, I fell in love with the entire continent and the cuisine. So that's here I'm kind of trying to do my own little version of kind of Italian regional cuisine, not just the Sicilian kind of Creole Italian food that we are accustomed to down here.
So you're sort of highlighting all the different regions of Italy through your food?
Yes, that's my goal.
Give me some examples of what's coming from a different region that would give us some contrast of what you're doing here.
Sure. Well, our polpette, for instance, I mean, most people, which is a meatball, most people here are accustomed to a meatball with tomato sauce. And kind of in northern Italy, they traditionally would serve it kind of how we're doing, just in like a chicken broth or something like that. Whereas down in the south, they have the great tomatoes and all that, so they would do that in a tomato broth. The octopus that we have, the Samarillo sauce, that's a sauce that is native to Sicily. It's just garlic, olive oil, a little salt, parsley, and oregano traditionally. And then all our pastas, like the amatriciana, that is a traditional, that's one of the big Roman pasta dishes.
And are you all making your pasta here?
Yes. We make all our pasta in-house.
That's a lot of labor. That's pretty labor intensive.
It is, but it's a lot of fun, too. My cousin always jokes. He's like, every time I walk by you, you're on that pasta machine.
What do you think are the biggest mistakes that people make with their pasta? Tell me what your pasta cooking philosophy is.
I think people overdress it, and I think you should finish your pasta in the pan with the sauce. Like, cook it about 80 to 90% of where you want it, put it in the pan with whatever your sauce, toss it in there and let it cook with your sauce, so that way it kind of goes into the pasta and the pasta picks it up. And add a little bit of that starchy pasta water, because I think that it kind of brings it all together, thickens the sauce a little bit. And that's definitely a restaurant trick, is to add that pasta water to it.
As the water started boiling, Nick grabbed a bowl of freshly made pasta, balsamic vinegar, and a container filled with truffles on top of a bed of raw risotto rice.
Oh, the scent of the truffles coming out of this container. So
I know, it's pretty awesome. I like that smell.
So tell me why you've got the truffles stored like this. And they're in, obviously, some risotto rice.
Right.
So I guess some lucky person gets to eat this rice later?
Definitely. So you store them in the risotto to keep them dry, so the rice actually absorbs all the moisture. But then also the rice picks up that awesome truffle aromatic flavor. So as time goes on, we'll use this rice as a special or something, make a truffle risotto, and then use, start another batch. So kind of doing double duty here, making some delicious risotto and then also storing our truffles.
Well, you know, this is a pretty unusual thing to find. Kind of honestly, since Baco went away all those years ago, I haven't seen anybody doing a serious truffle menu. What made you decide to do this?
I fell in love with truffles, just cooking and eating them, and the most basic pasta dish I ever had was pappardelle with shaved truffles on top, and it's one of those dishes that you remember. You know, I'm sure you have those dishes that you can recall, and that was definitely one of those dishes. And when I found that I could get them available to me down here, it was a no-brainer. And like you said, I don't think a lot of people are doing it, so I think it's something new to kind of bring to people down here in New Orleans.
So where are your truffles coming from?
They're black summer Italian truffles that are flown in from Italy to the Northwest and then straight to us.
And how long do they last? How long can you get them? And then once you've got them, how long will they stay good stored in the rice like that?
Just about a week or so. So you got to use them pretty quickly. You want to use them because they lose that truffle essence.
What makes that pasta slightly pale green?
I do herb puree, and I take herbs and I blanch them, shock them in ice water, and then I puree my eggs with the herbs to give it this green, and then mix it into the dough.
Oh, I bet it makes it taste good too.
Yeah, it gives a nice little herby flavor to it. So I'm dropping the pasta in salted water, some extra virgin olive oil.
What is so amazing is how quickly this freshly made pasta cooks, isn't it?
Yeah, just 2 to 3 minutes, that's it.
Pasta and butter, Poppy's two number one comfort foods.
Yeah, that's what I got when I came home from school. My mom would make penne pasta with Parmesan and butter. Sit down and watch my cartoons and eat my penne pasta. A little Parmesan.
Beautiful. It looks so creamy and there's no cream in it at all. It's
exactly
just that beautiful butter.
That butter and that starchy water from the pasta. So I finish it with a little extra parm.
Okay, now it's the good time for
now
the good
it's the
stuff.
Time. You shave. This is a truffle shaver. It's kind of like a mandolin, super sharp blade. You just want to slice your truffles super thin.
And is this something that the truffle sniffing pigs and dogs both are required to find the truffles?
Yes, that's it. They're found in Italy, I believe in the central part of Italy, in wooded areas to the base of trees. And actually, I believe the truffle uses the tree root as kind of it's parasitic towards the root and lives off of there. And yeah, they had pigs originally would find them, but recently they've trained dogs to go and find them because the pigs would actually eat the truffles before the farmer or whoever was foraging for them could get them.
Okay, well, is it time for us to taste?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, let's do it.
That is for you.
Okay. Well, I can't wait another instant to taste this. Oh, my goodness gracious, it is so
beautiful.
So, let's see.
Indescribably exotic.
Thank you.
Really, 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 really good. That's so wonderful.
Well, Nick, this has been an enlightening feast here at Restaurant Avo. Thank you so much for welcoming us into the kitchen and the dining room. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Chef Nick Lama of Avo Restaurant. Italian immigrants have left their mark on many communities in Louisiana, especially in New Orleans and the southeastern part of the state. But these families, many of whom were Sicilians, hailing from places like Palermo and Cefalù, also found their way to North Louisiana. Our Louisiana Eats roving reporter Chris Jay filed this report.
In Shreveport, there are Italian-owned fine dining establishments, a few historic sandwich shops with Italian roots, and a personal favorite of mine, Gullo's Fresh Produce and Bake Shop. Gullo's is an old-fashioned roadside produce stand that also serves plate lunches to go, and it's the only place I can think of that serves both chicken fried steaks and handmade cannoli. It's a little bit country, a little bit old country, and entirely unlike any other place in Shreveport. Teresa Gullo Hamilton, daughter of Gullo's founders John and Retha Gullo, still operates the business. As a child, she worked this land alongside her grandfather, a first-generation Sicilian immigrant and truck farmer.
We got up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, as soon as the sun was light enough. Right, every summer, we got paid not by the hour, but we got paid by what we produced for him at the end of the day. Now, our days were over with about 10:30 or 11 o'clock in the morning because it got hot. And we would go in and my grandmother would cook a large meal up, and he would sit down in his chair and watch as the world turns.
In 1981, Teresa's parents opened a fresh produce stand on Flournoy Lucas Road in South Shreveport. Aided by the popularity of Retha's home cooking, the roadside business soon began selling hot lunches as well. Today's Gullo's is still this interesting hybrid of produce stand and plate lunch house.
They actually started this business under a pecan tree with a card table and a few tomatoes on it. My mother, who had always been such a good cook, then she started making a few things to go out there. She found that the more she made, the more people bought, and it just grew and grew and grew.
When John and Retha both passed away in 2011 after 30 years in business, Teresa and her cousin Patricia were among the family members who banded together to keep Gullo's Fresh Produce and Bake Shop alive.
When your family's gone, the stuff that you took for granted, just the daily stuff they did every day, the smells when you walk in that kitchen and you smell something and you think it brings you back 40 years ago, you know, it's pretty cool, I think.
It's still a family affair, as Teresa and Patricia are taking the opportunity to bring a new generation into the kitchen.
We're making them do it, whether they want to do it or they don't.
Yeah.
I mean,
when Craig would come home from college, I'm like, you got to work store this summer.
Well, I don't want to work store. I don't care. You're working a store. You can't be here if you don't work, okay? Like, that's just a deal we have.
If there's any dish that embodies the Gullo story of Sicilian immigrants becoming true blue Southerners, it's the family's recipe for cherry cannoli. Unlike many versions, which use ricotta cheese for the filling, the Gullo's version is filled with a simple custard flavored with chopped maraschino cherries. Biting into one for the first time, I crunched through the crispy pastry tube dusted with powdered sugar and into that custard filling, which instantly reminded me of every dessert my Arkansas-raised grandmother brought to family get-togethers.
I've met chefs from all over the place, you know, at different restaurants and stuff, and they all have that same basic ricotta cheese, and I'm like, where'd that come from? Because we didn't have that, you know?
I don't know if our relatives couldn't afford the cheese back then. And they just made it work with what they had.
We didn't have these all the time. Like, I don't remember my grandmother making these, like, just every Sunday or something. It was like a special occasion day when we had them.
Usually, when I stop in at Gullo's, I get one of their fantastic cheeseburgers and eat it at a picnic table in the pecan grove that surrounds the little shop. I can never help wondering how this place has hung on, even as more and more restaurants have opened nearby. Selling a box of cannoli here, a jar of Mayhaw jelly there, how do they do it? Maybe the better question is, why do they do it?
I've had people come along and say, why do you keep that place open? Why would we close this place? It's our family, you know. It's love. It's what we do. It's not about how much money you make, because I'm telling you, it's not, you're not getting rich here. It's just about what you do. So it's you know, when we do the traditional things like the St. Joseph spaghetti and stuff, it's all we can do to just keep doing that, because it's what keeps our hearts alive and keeps that stuff going within us.
For Louisiana Eats, I'm Chris J.
To find out more about what's happening in Shreveport, visit Chris J's blog at 20by49.com.
I have kissed you, so I'll miss you. On the road, I'll be wanting you. But I have you, cause I love you. And you have me, cause you love me too. Yeah.
When we come back from a short break, Chef Cal Peternell joins us to talk about his new project, a cookbook that focuses on his restaurant family at Alice Waters Chez Panisse. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
My name is Cal Peternell. I am chef at Chez Panisse. I've been there for 20 years, and I'm working on my second cookbook.
Cal Peternell knows that a recipe is only as good as its ingredients. As the chef at Chez Panisse, Cal Peternell is keeping Alice Waters' vision for sourcing the very best local seasonal ingredients alive and well. Cal drew from Alice's simple philosophy of food in his first cookbook, 12 Recipes, a book that provides a simple yet comprehensive guide to approachable recipes for cooks of all levels. During their latest visit to New Orleans, Cal and his wife Kathleen came to visit us in the Louisiana Eats studio at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and Cal gave us the scoop on the inspiration for his forthcoming cookbook.
Well, this book is sort of a working title, and I don't know where it's going to go, but I like the working title of Two Kitchens, because this is a book that mixes together my Chez Panisse kitchen and my home kitchen, which is a natural for me and is something that is what I do at home and at work. There's not a bright line between the two. But I kind of tried to make that bright line for the first book because I really wanted that book to be really inclusive and approachable and not intimidate in any way. And so I felt like leaving the sort of professional chefing style cooking out of it would do that, would allow people to not feel like only a chef can make these dishes, which is not to say that this book won't also be approachable. For example, in 12 recipes, there was, I don't know if you remember the sauce recipes, there's three sauces.
And mayonnaise, what are those sauces?
Mayonnaise, salsa verde, and bechamel, and all the variations on those, which are many. But this book has, I forget how many now, but at least a dozen different kinds of sauces. And some are including those three, but say you've read 12 recipes and you feel engaged by it and you're ready kind of to invest a little more time, or if you have access to better or more varied ingredients, if you've gotten yourself a cast iron pan and maybe you even have like a electric mixer or something in your house and you're just ready to kind of do some project-based cooking that will keep you in the kitchen for a little bit more time because you enjoy the time, that's what this is going to be.
Well,
another qualifier for wanting this book is if you've been to Chez Panisse and love the food there.
Right.
So illustrate for me this process. How are you choosing the recipes? How do you recipe test? Do you have a vision of what the book's going to look like?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be consistent with the first book. You know, the photography is very natural. We did it in our home for the first book and this one as well. The plates are a little more sort of carefully composed, a little more of the composition of color and texture that really appeals to me and what I like to do at Chez Panisse to make plates that are really lively and colorful and engaging. You know, the concept of the first book, the sort of seed of the idea came about when my oldest son was leaving to go to college, and that was, he's graduated now, so 5 years ago. And it was, you know, the dishes that he could cook in his little galley kitchen and with the stuff that he got at the little bodega on the corner. And he has since become quite a good cook, has worked at numerous restaurants over the summers. And in this spring of this year, he cooked with us at the restaurant at Chez Panisse. And so over those 6 months that I was cooking with him, I really just kind of paid attention to what we were making and how he fit into those things, where he needed a little coaching and where he needed direction. So the book, in a way, kind of wrote itself. You know, it comes from that rediscovering the things we do, sort of trying to see it through his eyes. And so I would take the menus home and go over them, and not every one of them had to do with my son Henderson, but they were dishes that either had some relationship to him or ones that I just felt like were really doable at home that could take people's cooking sort of up a notch and, you know, just be kind of showstoppers. You know, if you have a dinner and you have some friends over and you bring this out, everyone's going to be quiet for a minute and pay attention.
I think that one of the biggest themes in my mind at Chez Panisse is ingredients, ingredients, ingredients. It's all ingredient driven.
Yeah.
And not everybody, unfortunately, lives right there in the heart of the Garden of Eden like you all do in Berkeley.
Right.
So for the home cook, how are they going to deal with that element?
I have to admit that in this new book, there are a few places where in the introduction to a recipe, I might say, you know, this is one to make when you have the perfect fat, fresh spears of asparagus that are just so good that you feel like doing anything other than just maybe just eating them raw or boiling them, you know, in salted water would be wrong. You know, if you don't have that, here's the other thing. You could roast them and put a little pecorino on them or do something else. So I'm trying to give kind of those options because I do know that that's true. But luckily, I think more and more, and in thanks in no small part to Alice and what she's done, people do have more and more, I think, access to really good ingredients. And there's more farmers markets. There's a lot more people who are getting stuff directly from farmers. For example, we just had an unbelievably good vegetable lunch at Shaya. And we were so happy to be eating all these delicious vegetables. And I was like, I wonder about the sourcing and how careful that's being done. And my wife, Kathleen, she said, it tastes like it's being done pretty carefully. And you really can you can tell when someone is really paying attention in that way. And I know that not everyone's going to have the time or the ability to take that kind of care, or they just don't have access. So there are, or I try to leave it open to like, it's okay, you can use something else, a different quality ingredient, or here's one where you can kind of use anything. I think everyone should try to get the best organic local vegetables they can find and meats and everything. And if they can't find it, they should be talking to the people who are selling them food so that they know that the demand is there and then maybe it'll show up. But in the meantime, I think everyone should get in the kitchen and cook. And if those other sort of ingredients are all they can find, there's ways to make them really delicious.
For a lover of Chez Panisse like me, can you tell me what am I going to find that's going to say, there's Chez Panisse right there in the book. I'm going to put it on my own dinner table.
There's a lot of salads, so you know that at Chez Panisse we do good salads, and not just lettuce salads, but all kinds of vegetable salads, cooked vegetables, raw vegetables. So I think that you'll really recognize that because that is kind of our – our thing. It has become something that I can't really live without. There's more desserts, and they're very fruit-based, again, which is something that we do there. There wasn't a lot of fish in the first book because fish can be a little problematic for a number of reasons. It's sometimes hard to find the good fresh fish, and also I feel like you need to buy fish responsibly. You need to pay attention to where it's coming from and how it was caught and the state of the fishery. And so I'm including more fish with some gentle nudges in the direction of getting people to think about buying fish in a responsible way.
Well, that's great because there's nothing that we love down here like fish. So I know everybody, just like me, is going to be dying to get their hands on your new book when it comes out next year. And Cal, I hope when you've got that book in hand, you will make a beeline back to New Orleans to see us, and we'll do some rocking cooking in in the kitchen.
I'll see you then. Thanks, Poppy.
Thanks, Cal. Cal Peternell, chef at Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. For over 100 years, the Empestada family first created and then preserved a New Orleans French Quarter gem, the Napoleon House. The location was originally a corner grocery. Uncle Joe Empestada, patriarch of the family, altered the traditional Italian grocery model by first turning a side room into a Prohibition-era speakeasy where opera records spun on his Victrola. Ensuing generations transformed it into the charming cafe and bar it is today. A place where the Pimm's cups are always cold and the classic Mufalata sandwiches are always toasty warm. In 2015, Sal Empestada personally invited Ralph Brennan to consider taking over the reins of his family's legacy. Ralph accepted the honor and is now the keeper of the flame at New Orleans Napoleon House. Tradition continues. After all, who better than a Brennan to understand family tradition? Ralph's been careful not to change a thing that would alter the trip back in time that is the New Orleans Napoleon House.
I understood that from the beginning. Don't try to change it. I guess that helped me keep it going all those years. I never worried about what everybody else was serving or doing. I just kept going. But we were always improving. The immigrants here, I guess, way to bring in income was to operate neighborhood grocery stores. That start right there helped my uncle purchase other properties. So that's how he got his start. The opera music started with my uncle, mainly because he was old school Italian and that's all he knew. When my dad took over, he expanded it into classical.
This building has as much historical value to it as the cathedral does. It's top ranked historical value.
When my dad took sick, I thought I'd finish out my term in the service and go in and help him out, let him sort of back off on retirement. There really was no other should I or shouldn't I, because my wife even told me you shouldn't. But I said, no, I wanted to take it over, I wanted to keep it in the family.
Because this business was not a real big money maker down here. It's hard to keep this place the same as it is, you know, without change.
When I took over, we were chipping ice for an ice pick. The ice would be delivered in 100-pound blocks, and you'd have to go out there and chip out a quarter of it, then bring it in a block to the ice bins and then chip it down. You'd have to go into work an hour or so earlier just to get the ice ready. When I put in air conditioning in the 80s, that was probably the biggest step after the ice machine.
86, we made the reception area out of an apartment actually that I lived in for a few years before I moved out to Metairie. Originally, it was the family's apartment.
Friday afternoons were, you know, always busy with a lot of locals. We had a group of teachers that came in every Friday, sat in the same spot, drank the same beer, you know, every Friday. I think the 70s was the sort of changeover between the quarter being a neighborhood and now becoming a tourist attraction. I just noticed it more and more as the years went by from my initial 71 takeover.
People that had traveled in Europe told me that it was just so much like a European establishment, you know.
But even to today, you'll see the tourists and the locals mingle a lot. I think the local attraction has come back, and it's not an older crowd, it's a younger crowd. And they appreciate the way the place is run. When it's all done and I don't really have to do anything anymore, I can say, well, then I'll say I'll retire. But right now, you know, it's still coming here every day. I still feel like it's my place, you know, and I'll pick up napkins off the floor and I'll straighten this out. It's just what I've been doing for over 40 years. There's very few places that aren't stiff. You don't have to be pretentious or anything here.
This interview with Sal Impastato was conducted by Mark Cave for the Historic New Orleans Collection and produced by Thomas Walsh for NOLA Life Stories. Muffalata sandwich is said to have been invented at Central Grocery on Decatur Street in the French Quarter. Central was founded by Sicilian immigrant Salvatore Lupo. Located across from the French Market, the Italian vendors from the old market would cross the street at lunchtime, and Mr. Lupo would pile the traditional antipasto ingredients on a round, seeded Italian loaf that was called a muffalata, thus giving the sandwich a name. One of the most important ingredients in a muffalata is the olive salad, which acts both as an integral part of the sandwich as well as the dressing. The olive salad is piled on high, and when the top of the muffalata loaf hits that olive oil-laden goodness, it soaks into the bread. If you can wait long enough to eat that muffalata, wrap it in aluminum foil and run it into a hot oven to get toasty warm and have the cheese begin to melt. Yum! You can get your muffalata to go at Central Grocery, or you can enjoy one in the beautiful courtyard of the Napoleon House, or you can give it a try yourself at home. There's lots of delicious olive salads in the jar at your local grocery, but you can give making your own olive salad a try. You'll find my recipe for olive salad on our Louisiana Eats website at poppytooker.com, itsneworleans.com, and of course, on our host station, wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and traditional New Orleans olive salad on a muffalata loaf is real Louisiana Eats. What to do with your pasta cooking water? Stay tuned, and when we come back, you'll never drain that goodness into the sink again. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What to do with your pasta cooking water? For goodness sake, don't pour it down the drain. No matter how you're planning on serving that pasta, the cooking liquid is an essential ingredient for perfection. In most restaurant kitchens where a lot of pasta is cooked, the chefs put the raw pasta into a handled basket that's lowered into the boiling salted water. And by the way, don't forget that salt. If you forget to salt your water before cooking pasta, no matter how much saltiness you add to the pasta later, your dish will always taste flat and dull. Ready to eat some pasta? Begin by making your sauce as the pasta cooks. A little olive oil, a little butter if you'd like, and of course garlic, all sautéed together. As soon as the pasta is al dente, add a tablespoon or so of the cooking liquid to the sauté pan. Keep shaking the pan while the water reduces slightly with the rest of the ingredients, and you'll see a magic trick happen. That sauce will have a natural creaminess to it without using any cream at all. It's the starchy water of the cooking liquid that makes that magic. Now it's time to toss in the pasta and top with grated cheese if you'd like. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. Native New Orleanian Randy Fertel is a man who wears many hats. College professor, writer, philanthropist, but perhaps most significantly, Randy's the son of the Empress of Steak, Ruth U. Fertel. We spoke with Randy about his mother, founder of the now worldwide Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. Ruth Fertel, the whole course of her life, I think, was altered that day, May 24th, 1965, when she took possession of the Chris Steakhouse on North Broad in New Orleans. Tell us what led up to that day.
Well, she was a hard-working gal, and they had this litigious divorce that went on for years and years, and finally it was settled, and she didn't think she could afford to send me and my brother Jerry to college on the $380 a month she was making. So she found the three-line want ad, steakhouse for sale, owner retiring, call this number. And he wanted $18,000. And my mother took that to her banker at Bank of Louisiana. And he said, well, this looks like a good deal, but you know, Ruth, you're going to need some working capital for inventory and stuff. So she was very capable, but she wasn't really ready for prime time. And he helped her through that first hurdle of making a go of it. So it started slow, and she was serving maybe 35 steaks a day. And one day she was complaining to one of her customers about, you know, slack business. And he said, oh, I didn't know you wanted more customers. Like she wouldn't. I didn't know you wanted more customers. I work in the oil patch across the river, and all those guys, they're from Texas. They know a good steak. So I'll bring them over here. Well, the next thing you know, it's the place for lunch for the oil patch, three martini lunches. And after that, you know, the politicians follow the money. So now it's the power lunch with the politicians and the uptown people. Before that, it had just been the kind of joint that you stopped on your way back from the track when you had a good day. So she bought Chris Steakhouse, and when it started expanding, she needed to change the name, so she added her name in that New Orleans tradition of stringing names together.
So steakhouses in America are a dime a dozen. What do you think set Ruth's Chris apart?
Well, they're a dime a dozen in part because of my mother. I once had the experience of chatting with Arnie Morton, whose family founded Morton Steakhouse. And he said, your mother created the prime steak business. I said, well, when did your family start? He said, well, in the 20s. But I'll still tell you that your mother created the prime steak business. And I think what he meant was that she created the market. She created this much broader market. It wasn't this niche market. It was this really desirable thing that everyone aspired to and decided they could afford it, even if they couldn't, because it was so desirable.
So tell me, how did the enormous expansion take place from the one restaurant on North Broad to really the whole world?
Of course, the original was Broad and Ursuline, not Broad and Orleans, and it was this tiny little joint that had been founded by Chris Matalich in 1927, and it only had 17 tables. And in the early 70s, she had a customer, Tom Moran, from Baton Rouge, who kept saying, "Ruth, if you don't let me open my own Chris Steakhouse in Baton Rouge, then I'm going to kill myself on the highway, and it's going to be on your eternal soul." He was a dramatic Irishman. So eventually she, you know, got tired of his complaining and said, okay. And so he opened in Prairieville in the middle of chemical plants, and it was a huge success. It became the big political hang in Baton Rouge, and later he moved closer to downtown. But from that, you know, next Bob Ruby, who was a radio personality, took a franchise to Houston, and it just started growing. She was very early, I think, in this franchising of America movement, and probably I've never seen anyone on the high end like her. I think she was the first to do high-end franchising. And it wasn't about big franchise fee. It was about finding the right people who were going to be warm and welcoming and do the food the way she wanted.
How did she maintain the quality in all those restaurants?
Well, that was the big challenge, and there was a lot of ups and downs in that regard. And, you know, we'd get reports, and she often traveled to other cities to see what's what and try to adjust things. But, you know, the thing about franchising is that, you know, once you're in business, you're sure that you know more than the original. There's a story about Tom Moran that he was once a bit inebriated at the bar at the Ruth's Chris in Lafayette. And he was talking to Rosemary, the manager, and he said, "You know why I hate Ruth Fertel? Because she's smarter than me."
Your mom was smarter than just about everybody,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, she was a whip.
Well, if your mother invented the prime steak market, then you literally had a hand in it, because one of your early jobs was helping to butcher the meat. You literally wielded the saw, didn't you?
Well, I was an underachieving student at Ben Franklin in 1965 when she bought Chris Steakhouse. And so I was kind of looking for reasons not to study. So I started working as a busser and helped her butcher. And back then, there were only two steaks, well, three steaks. They all came off the short loin. There was the porterhouse, and there was the filet, which is the rest of the tenderloin, and the strips. So you had this 30 to 35-pound short loin, which had your entire inventory in it, and you had to cut through the bone with a hacksaw to get the steaks. That only lasted about a week, and then she went out and bought a bandsaw. But I helped her with that, and, you know, I was a young man, so it was hard work, but my mother was, you know, 5'2" and 110 pounds and throwing around 35-pound loins, so she was tough.
Tell us about your Uncle Martin's home remedy that ended up on the menu.
Well, I was really pleased. I was hanging out with my cousin Joanne in Houston, and we're driving along to go see another cousin. You know, I'm doing research. And she said, "Well, you know that cream spinach on your mother's menu, that's Uncle Martin's cream spinach." And that was such a revelation, because Ruth's Chris does not trumpet my mother's roots in the Delta. But there's a number of ways in which Ruth's Chris really is rooted in that incredible culinary family that she grew up in. Of course, Plaquemines is where many of our foodstuffs comes from Creole tomatoes to oysters and shrimp and trout. So there's stories about my great-great-grandmother. She was known as Grandmom. She didn't speak English. She, for Christmas and Thanksgiving, would send the menfolk out in the bayou to get 17 sacks of oysters, which they would bring in and shuck on the back porch, and then she would make oyster dressing for 35. And for the rest of my mother's life, she recreated that dinner. And so when she opened Chris Steakhouse and she started expanding the menu, first it was just potatoes and salad, and then she, you know, added some other things. And cream spinach was one of those things she added. And that cream spinach was my great Uncle Martin's cream spinach, and he was the great cook in the family.
Let's talk about how the race barrier was broken at Ruth's Chris. I was fascinated to read about that because people always think of it being a Dookie Chase.
Well, the first black man who ate at Chris Steakhouse, Lolis Edward Eli, great civil rights attorney, was invited to lunch at Chris Steakhouse. There was some white guy running for judge or something who wanted Lolis's support in the black community, which of course he wasn't going to get because Lolis was a liberal guy and this guy was conservative. But Lolis knew a good deal when he heard it. So he's a bon vivant. He wanted a good steak. So he said yes. So they go in, and next thing you know, the floor is a titter. And this white cracker, I imagine it was, walked up to my mother and looked down at her from his great height and said, "If that boy eats here, I'll never eat here again." And my mother, who was from the most racist parish in the state, but did not grow up racist with her Norwegian and Alsatian family, said, "Well, I'll see ya." And and I just love that story. So the Public Accommodations Act was 1963, but I've heard it said many times that that barrier was broken storefront by storefront. And so it had to have been after 65. I'm not exactly sure if it was 65 or 66, but that's when Chris Steakhouse was integrated.
And it really was a great political hotbed. Please share with us the red beans and rice tradition on Mondays following elections.
Well, on Friday before an election, everyone gathered. I mean, if you were a political guy or a political hanger-on or a political commentator, you were at Ruth's Chris and you were watching what deals were being made and table hopping, and Hippo Katz was holding court. He was this wonderful, irrepressible guy whose name came from his great weight, and it was not a nickname you said behind his back. It was just his name, Hippo Katz. But he was this just uncanny prognosticator of elections, and he would make bets on, you know, so-and-so was going to win by 0.4% or whatever. So on Monday, everyone came to pay up their debts or scoop their winnings. And there was this tradition that the winners got a free steak and the losers got red beans and rice that my mother had cooked with her own hand.
But there was a little trick when the check came, huh?
Yeah, they paid full fare for the red beans.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming to talk with us on Louisiana Eats.
So happy to be here.
Randy Fertel, son of the Empress of Steak, Ruth U. Fertel. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we discuss the ethics of eating meat with food journalist Corby Kummer.
I think I come to the place that a lot of people come to, which is, yes, I am a moral hypocrite. I am going to live with my hypocrisy and live in the fond belief that I have power in my purchasing power.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.